Welcome to the podcast series The New Student Pharmacist, where we discuss chemistry and pharmacy, as well as leaders in pharmacy careers, community, and chemistry and pharmacy research. We encourage you to support the work we are doing and follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by subscribing for free. Note, the views on the podcast represent those of my guest and I.
Purpose of these episodes not at all for advice or medical suggestions. These are aimed to provide support to peer pharmacists in training in educational and intellectually stimulating ways. Again, these are not at all for medical advice or medical suggestions. Please see your local board and state-certified health professional. The views of this podcast represent those of my guests and I.
Welcome to the New Chemist Podcast. We're glad you're listening. Feel free to download this podcast on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Here on The New Chemist, we discuss chemistry, which simply put is the science of change, as well as the other sciences, careers, community, research, and COVID-19. We're happy you're tuning in. My guest today is Dr. Emery Brown. Thanks for joining me today. It is so good to hear from you. Just briefly, I'll inform my audience about you. Dr. Emery N. Brown is the Edward Hood Professor of Medical Engineering and Computational Neuroscience at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The Warren M. Zappel Professor of Anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and a practicing anesthesiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Brown received his BA, magna cum laude, in Applied Mathematics from Harvard College, his MA and his PhD in Statistics from Harvard University, and his MD magna cum laude from Harvard Medical School. Dr. Brown is an anesthesiologist statistician whose experimental research has made important contributions towards understanding the neuroscience of how anesthetics act in the brain to create the states of general anesthesia. In his statistics research, he has developed signal processing algorithms to solve important data analysis challenges in neuroscience. His research has been featured on National Public Radio, in Scientific American, Technology Review, The New York Times, and in TEDMed 2014. He serves as the director of the Harvard MIT Health Sciences and Technology Program, the associate director of the Institute for Medical Engineering and Science at MIT, an investigator at the PCOR Center for Learning and Memory, Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. He's a fellow of the Institute of Mathematical Statistics, fellow of the National Academy of Inventors, a member of the National Academy of Engineering, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and a member of the National Academy of Medicine. In 2007, he was given the NIH Director's Pioneer Award. He's also a member of the Association of University Anesthesiologists. These are just a few of his accomplishments. A very distinguished scientist, please welcome Dr. Emery. Chemistry field highlights. Femtochemistry. So surveying the literature, I'm looking at the work of Yoshitaka Tanimura, Koichi Yamashita, and Philip A. Anfinrod. We embark on a new discussion, femtochemistry. In short, a key feature of chemistry is the homolysis or breaking and or the formation of bonds, which some consider to be theoretical constructs in some instances. A key feature of the elementary steps of bond making and breaking are molecular vibrations, which occur approximately at the 10 femtosecond scale. So, okay, with this, view in mind, ultra-fast processes are or is a phrase that can definitely describe chemical reactions and has been umbrellaed or covered or falls under the term femtochemistry.
Thanks, Dr. Brown, for joining me today. It's so good to have a distinguished scientist as such as you on this podcast. So, Dr. Brown, what have been your longstanding interests in the field of science? Can you just discuss some of those?
Well, I think they varied over time. I think that probably my strongest interest in science began in college when I got interested in statistics. So being a statistician, developing statistical methods and algorithms that people could really use to analyze data became an early interest of mine. And that's something which I pursued, you know, throughout my career. First working on studying outcomes from surgery as an undergraduate, then later studying circadian rhythms during my PhD work.
Okay.
After that, looking at developing algorithms in general for neuroscience data analysis, for looking at neural spike trains, for looking at EEG, local field potentials, and these sorts of things.
Okay.
And then from there, my interest developed into trying to understand anesthesia. So I'd say those are probably the principal focus areas. So statistics, and then statistics applied to neuroscience, and then anesthesiology, the mechanism of general anesthesia.
So I think by any standard of measurement, or most standards of measurement, most people would say you have been a successful academician. You have achieved your PhD from Harvard, your MD from Harvard, MA from Harvard, BA from Harvard. You've won numerous prizes. You're part of many societies, the National Academy of Inventors, National Academy of Science, National Academy of Engineering, National Academy of Medicine. So how do you maintain view of the bigger picture in your career and in your life in general? How are you doing that?
And so when you say the bigger picture, you're referring to?
Academically and also personally. How do you maintain view of the bigger picture in terms of like the overarching goals that you have set, your mission statement, your vision for your life?
Well, I think that one of the things that I've tried to do is try to work on an important question.
Okay.
And what you find out with important questions is you can't solve them in 5 minutes. So that necessarily creates like a long trajectory. So for example, the problem of thinking on how does anesthesia work, and that's something which has been a question for now coming near 175 years. And so picking part of that and going after it, you know, it's something which is going to be, it's a challenging question. And if you're able to solve it, it's going to have broad implications, not only for taking care of patients, but also for neuroscience in general and science in general. So that's the sort of things I've tried to work on, like picking important questions. So as another illustration, in thinking about circadian rhythms are everywhere. They control our daily function. So the more we're able to accurately quantify how they, their properties, again, it has broad implications. So I guess the two-sentence summary would be picking important questions and pursuing those important questions.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's good. So in what specific ways, for the layman, have you been adaptive and creative in the field of science? What specific ways? I know you work with anesthesia, I know you've been a statistician. What specific ways have you added your flair to those fields?
Well, I think that if we start with like the circadian rhythms, I think right there was the main thing that I did was in looking at the data that were being recorded at those times, like looking at core temperature rhythms to track the circadian system in patients or in study subjects.
Mm-hmm.
I worked to give an accurate description of those oscillations.
Okay.
So trying to make the model capture the structure and the data as accurately as possible, and using what we call harmonic regression techniques to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But then not just stopping there, but developing a full inference framework so you could measure the aspects of the rhythm, you know, say the period, the amplitude, and then from there be able to make statements of uncertainty about, you know, how confident we were about the characterizations that we came up with.
Wow.
So that allows you to have an inference framework. And then going on to some of the other work, like looking at neuroscience data, the same idea in principle, but there was the key concept there that I was able to take advantage of and use, and I've continued to use throughout my career, and that is neuroscience data, because they're recording from the brain and central nervous system, is dynamic. It changes over time. Mm-hmm. And you need statistical methods that also capture those changes over time for it to be accurate. And so those were things that I was practicing that I learned as part of my PhD training. So whereas most of the methods that were being used are static. Mm-hmm. And so then it becomes like a kludge to really use them. So by starting from a framework where I already had methods that were dynamic, mm-hmm. that kept the phenomena that changed over time, I was able to develop more accurate descriptions of those sorts of data as well. So in other words, really understanding the properties of the data, really what the essential elements of the problem are, I think that's something which I've tried to focus on, and that's, you know, yielded me some, you know, some measure of success to date.
Yeah, I would say so too, it did. So how have you sought or found the right environment for you to thrive scientifically and intellectually? I think a lot of people aim or aspire to be at institutions such as Harvard and other institutions as well. So how do you know that was the right environment for you to thrive in, scientifically and intellectually?
Well, I can't say that I knew it. I mean, I think I was just like any other student starting off at, you know, like Harvard, you know, really in many respects impressed by what the institution had to offer. Mm-hmm. But then once I was there, then saying, well, I really have to take advantage of this. And I remember specifically that when I was a junior and I was thinking about what I wanted to do for my research for senior thesis, Ken Wachter, who was a professor in the statistics department at the time, said, well, since you're thinking about going to medical school, you should probably write a thesis, an undergraduate thesis on a medical topic. And he suggested I go and talk with Professor Fred Mosteller about that particular issue. Mm-hmm. and developing a research project with him because he was a statistician who was working on studying outcomes from surgery. Mm-hmm. And that this would be a good idea for me to join a project like that. So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So I guess the key thing was realizing that what sort of opportunities were there, mm-hmm. at Harvard, and then taking advantage of them, because you could certainly be there and not take advantage of opportunities that were there.
That's true.
I think one of the real things that I think it was the case at the time, I think it still continues to be the case, the opportunity to write a senior thesis with, you know, a leading scholar in the area is something which, you know, was amazingly beneficial for me for long term. Mm-hmm. It got to watch up close and personal how, you know, one of the top statisticians in the world did research. I got to see, you know, how he thought, how he interacted with, you know, other scientists, with physicians, and it was very helpful for me to think about the sort of scientist, and in my case also a physician, that I wanted to be, and the way I'd like to be able to do research. And being very specific, one thing about Professor Mosteller was that he could work with anybody. He could work with the best statistician, you know, the top physicians, mm-hmm. graduate students, postdocs, but he could also work with undergraduates like me. And so having, you know, just basically seeing that, and I can honestly say that's something I tried to emulate.
Oh, wow. That's good. That's definitely good. So you speak about your desire to attend medical school in your junior year. So how did you delineate or decide between MD, PhD, or MD? Because I think that's a challenge that a lot of people encounter. How did you differentiate whether you want to choose MD, PhD, or MD?
Well, I think what happened was, is I knew when I came to college I wanted to go to medical school. That was for sure.
Okay.
And I can't remember exactly whether it was in my sophomore year or earlier, but I decided I wanted to do a PhD also. Mm-hmm. And once I really fell in love with statistics, which was between sophomore and junior year, mm-hmm. I decided I wanted to do my PhD in statistics because I just liked, I really liked statistics. It was just very powerful paradigm, very powerful framework, was and still is. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to master that. And I thought that, but I also wanted to be a physician. Mm-hmm. And I thought, as opposed to just compromising and doing one or the other, why not do both? And that was how I just made the decision. Mm-hmm. So it was a fairly avant-garde idea at the time because when I entered the Harvard MD PhD program, nobody had done a PhD in statistics before. That was a rather new idea. It was a new idea there, but also in other programs in the country, because it was people looked at me with a lot of surprise when I said that's what I wanted to do my PhD in. But it was very clear to me that, you know, medicine was a field that had a lot of uncertainty, mm-hmm. a lot of data, and even more now. And having people who are formally trained in how to quantify that uncertainty and make decisions on uncertainty just seemed like a natural path. And that's what I just decided to do.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So given all your responsibilities and accomplishments, Dr. Brown, how do you maintain a balanced life? Or how are you strive to maintain balance?
Well, it's, you know, I think, you know, family is first. There's no question about that. And, you know, the accomplishments are basically no fun, and they have no luster, you know, if your family isn't well taken care of and your family isn't happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we spend a lot of time, you know, on, you know, downtime on the weekends, vacationing, you know, during the summer, spring, when the kids were younger, sort of making sure we took, you know, vacations during the four seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my wife, like me, likes to travel. So we, and very often if I have trips to various places to give lectures, we turn them into sort of family outings also.
Okay.
So, you know, by doing that, it's made it possible to, you know, pursue activities that are relevant to my career, mm-hmm. but also to make sure that, you know, I'm not losing sight of my family.
Yeah, that's good. Priorities, having priorities. I've heard that in several interviews that having priorities that you complement to maintaining balance. So what would you attribute to your success as a pioneer in the field, Dr. Brown? What would you attribute, what characteristic, what was it, your upbringing as a child? Was it your time at Harvard, or was it your belief system, your perspective on life? What would you say has complemented your success as a pioneer in the field? Would it be mentorship?
I think that my parents and my family deserve tremendous credit for, mm-hmm. you know, sort of setting me on the right track. And so, for example, I mean, both of my parents were teachers. They felt that education was very important.
Okay.
Anytime I wanted to do something or pursue something, they were always behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, my brothers were always very, very good in school also.
Okay.
And so people would always say, well, you're going to be as good as your brother, you know, sort of things. So that also created a certain amount of incentive. But not only my brothers, but my cousins, too. They were also really very good in school. And so in other words, there were these, a number of, like, you know, sort of role models around, which,
wow.
I don't think we use that term then. We didn't think of them that way, but there were people you wanted to be like. So now we would call them role models, right?
Okay.
But, you know, one of my cousins, Robert Brown, who went to, you know, Carnegie Mellon, was a star basketball player, honor student, and he was always sitting around reading books, you know, during the summer. I mean, that's the image that I, you know, that I had of him. One of my cousins, who was, when we were kids, was teaching us lines from HMS Pinafore, you know, that sort of thing.
Wow.
So being smart was cool. Essentially, I really remember that idea. Like, the smarter you were in this environment around our family, kind of like, you know, the cooler you were.
Wow.
So, and so I think that kind of instilled this in me. Or for example, like my oldest brother is a very good writer,
mm-hmm.
and my middle brother was a physicist.
Wow.
Or, you know, just a retired physicist now.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it didn't seem like that at the time, but they were implicitly setting bars,
mm-hmm.
you know, for me to try to jump over.
Wow.
Just by what they were doing, you know, by example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are the origins. And then realizing once you had opportunities,
mm-hmm.
you took advantage of them.
Yeah.
And then you have some serendipity. You have some people who realize that you have, you know, potential, and they try to help you realize it.
Mm-hmm.
Like my language teacher at Exeter, you know, Mr. Baggio,
mm-hmm.
who spoke like five languages, and so I wanted to be like Mr. Baggio, you know, try to be as proficient in as many languages as he was.
Yeah.
Or, for example, when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, one of the anesthesiologists there, Dr. Jack McPeak, mm-hmm. you know, took an interest in me. He was one of my thesis advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the first person who took me to the operating room. And then, you know, several years later, when I decided to go into anesthesiology, I was able to turn to him and get advice, and he helped me, you know, arrange to take, you know, a rotation in anesthesiology, and decided that that's what I wanted to go into. So in addition to, so it's a number of things. It's not just, it's like any one thing.
That's good.
But, you know, so some, I'd say some young, some early on, some folks that I really looked up to, later on, some folks who realizing and acknowledging my potential, you know, who helped me out. And I was very grateful for that.
Wow. That's powerful. Yeah, so you spoke, and from my understanding, it seems like you grew up in a culture of excellence. Of course, I'm sure there were things that could have been improved on, but you said you grew up in an environment where it seems like everyone was pursuing excellence. What would you say? Would you say it was your parents or their brothers and sisters that contributed to that?
Oh, yeah. For example, yeah, like, so my mother's family grew up in Pittsburgh. And, my mother and her older sister, my mother was one of seven children.
Okay.
And so she was the second oldest, and her sister was extremely smart, you know, her older sister. My mother's extremely smart. She graduated from high school when she was 16.
Oh.
I remember my uncle, who was the next one in line, the third one, was saying to me, he says, you know, your mother and your aunt Anita made it hard for me because they had done so well in school. I had to do well too, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And, you know, on the other hand, my father was very industrious. I mean, he was someone who was orphaned. And he was 14. He and his brother had lost both his parents. They were raised by their grandfather.
Wow.
But they had someone who, my great-grandfather, was this amazing guy. He was a minister, but he was also a gentleman farmer.
Okay.
And he owned this very large parcel of land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there in Florida, where I grew up, which we still own today.
Okay.
And that he was an amazingly industrious person. And I know that rubbed off on my father, because my father was always doing stuff, both for the family, but also for the community. He was very committed to his community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, in fact, I know that, you know, I inherited that perspective, you know, those goals, those sort of can-do attitude that my father, you know, always had. And I'll just give you one example.
I'm here to listen.
At the time, my father's grandfather wanted him to move back to Florida, because after he got married, they lived in New York and in Pittsburgh. And he wanted him to move back because he wanted somebody living on the property. So my father decided to build a house. So this was in about 1957, 1958.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, my father couldn't get a loan from the bank to build a house.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, one of the most important things entering into the American dream is to be able to build a house and, you know, lay down roots, right?
Yes, I agree.
So I didn't know this until many years later. He actually borrowed money from an auto body shop to build a house. He couldn't get a loan from the bank.
Wow.
And I remember when we paid off the note, I must have been about 10 or 11 at the time, and I didn't quite understand everything, you know, that was going on, but I subsequently figured out what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was, is that because the conventional means that most, you know, Americans would have used to build a house, getting a loan from the bank and doing that, wasn't available to him, he had to come up with another strategy that would work.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it. And so I think about that now. I mean, think about if he'd not been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Where would I be now if he hadn't done that?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then taking from that, realizing that if people put obstacles in your way, you have to outthink them.
Yeah.
I mean, and I've seen myself do that, like, on a number of occasions. But that was probably one of the most, you know, concrete examples, because the people at the bank couldn't believe that an African American would want to build, like, a real house, you know, like a solid, you know, three bedroom, you know, two and a half bathroom, you know, living room, floor to room, you know, outside porch, you know, house. They figured we just had some idea of, like, little shanty or something like that. That was far from what my father imagined, because he had studied industrial arts in college, so he knew how to build things. Okay. And with help of his brother and his uncles, they actually built the house.
Wow, that's good. Wow. I'm learning a lot, Dr. Brown. So, how have you maintained vision and teamwork in your environment, in your lab, in your workspace in Mass General? How do you maintain vision and teamwork? How do you make sure that everyone's collaborating and seeing the big picture and trying to answer those important questions that you mentioned?
I think there are two things. I think one, you look for cool problems. Okay. And you get people excited about cool problems. I think that's the starting point. And then, you know, you let people loose and let them use their creativity to start working. You guide them. Mm-hmm. But at least this is what I like to do. I like to guide people to help them solve problems and then pitch in, you know, when they, you know, need my help, because it helps them to develop their creative capacities and you know, bring them to bear on a problem. Mm-hmm. I think that that's probably the most important thing, and also making it fun. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like in many regards now I'm more a cheerleader than anything else. I'm not so much the person like doing the work. I'm just the rah-rah-rah, you know, keeping them going and offering suggestions and making sure people aren't getting stuck. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the main thing that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly say it's fun. It's fun working with. You know, it's watching people who are, you know, many years my junior master concepts that I didn't master until I was like maybe 20 years older than they were. Like, wow, they know this stuff already. You can only imagine what they can do or what they'll be able to do even going on into the future. Mm-hmm. And so just sitting there marveling at that and trying to facilitate that is a real pleasure. And I try to keep that going on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, wow. So as we start to wrap up, you mentioned how being smart is cool. I can be wrong with this, however, I'm not sure if that's the prevailing message in many instances or in many circles. Mm-hmm. So what would you say could complement the change in that dynamic, where it's not just the athletic environments that have a lot of attraction to them for young people, but academic environments as well? You know, how can we make that a more prevailing message, that intellectual curiosity and intellectual development is worth the time and effort?
Yeah, I mean, I think we really have to. I mean, I'm clearly biased because I'm an academic and I'm in science, and people should know about academics and science and those sorts of things. But I think that you know, I'm indebted to you for taking time to talk to somebody like me to allow me to tell my story.
Oh,
because,
wow.
You know, it's, you know, it's more exciting to know, to hear about Jason Tatum having scored 50 points and won the game for the Celtics.
Oh, definitely.
About what I'm doing, you know. So, and that's just the reality, though.
That's true. But,
however, you know, being able to, like, for example, I have three, sort of, after my father, I have like three heroes, additional heroes in mathematics. You know, one is Benjamin Banneker, you know, the black mathematician who laid out DC. Mm-hmm. The first person to really characterize the cycles of the circadia, you know, the insects which come out every 17 years. Mm-hmm. So he was really, and he did this over something like four or five cycles. So he started when he was 17.
Okay.
And so he was probably the country's first data scientist, when you think about it. Or another person is Katherine Johnson. When I learned about her, I was just like blown away. Mm-hmm. You know, basically the woman mathematician, African-American woman mathematician, who worked out the flight trajectories for the early Mercury and I think also Gemini space missions. Mm-hmm. I mean, just think about it. She did the calculations by hand.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, that's just like unreal. And the third person who actually had the good fortune to meet is David Blackwell. He was African-American professor at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, professor of statistics. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like an amazing mind, soft-spoken, just totally respected because he was just so, so brilliant. First African-American elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1964. So more than 100 years after the Academy was actually set up, the first African-American was elected, it was he. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think about, you know, people like that, and I'm saying, gosh, if I can be anything like those guys, you know, so, you know, I you know, clearly, of LeBron James or Magic Johnson, the things that, you know, are often talked about, but like in my realm, you know, I see somebody like these people, they're like my heroes, and those are the people I aspire to be like.
Yeah, that's good. So as we conclude, do you have any advice to those wanting to pursue the field you are currently working in, so budding scientists? What advice would you give to those wanting to pursue the field you are currently working in, whether it be statistics or medicine or just a PhD in general?
I think they try to get involved and gain experience early. I can tell you, I get letters almost every day from students asking to come and work in my group. Literally, and of different ages, all the way from junior high school, you know, up through, you know, high school, college, postdocs. And I'm amazed at what some of these students have told me they already know. Some of them are from the United States, some are not. They're from outside, from basically, effectively, the four corners of the earth. And so, but realizing that that's what people do and not being bashful about doing that. And if the first time you write somebody, you don't hear from them, no big deal. Keep going if you want to. Because it's you're trying to create, because all you need is one opportunity to sort of get your foot in the door. Once you have that and you realize, and the other opportunities will open up. And you can see that this is something that students from a number of different backgrounds are actually doing now. I think that students in general, particularly perhaps, you know, underrepresented minority students, were free to take the same approach.
I agree. Completely agree. So what has been some of the most beneficial advice you have received, Dr. Brown, as we conclude? What is the most beneficial advice, or a piece of the beneficial advice that you received, either from your parents, as you mentioned, they were very industrious and intelligent, even from your colleagues or professors? What has been some of the most beneficial advice you have received?
A number of things. I think, you know, just in watching like my parents, you know, just like working hard and also, but then encouraging intellectual pursuits, you know. And I think I certainly have picked up on that and tried to amplify that. I just remember my mother saying at one point, like I told you, she was extremely smart. And, you know, she was. It was very clear she lived vicariously through us, you know, the things we were able to accomplish, you know, not only me, but my brothers as well. And one point, in sort of a more candid moment, she said, you know, if I had opportunities, I'm sure I could have been, you know, a lot more than I am now.
Yeah, I've heard that same sentiment from others
and that, as well. I mean, that kind of stuck with me and just sort of said, well, you know, I have an obligation to try to be as successful as I possibly can, because my mother made it possible for me to get to where I am now. And she sacrificed a lot to be where she was. And I should basically do the same thing. Then a complimentary idea. I just remember my uncle saying once that, you know, it never hurts to be nice. And so if you can help somebody, why not? You know, just,
I know, right?
Just that simple, not deep, but just, and it can take on many forms. It can just be meeting someone on the street to helping someone with their career. So I think somewhere in there, some of the best advice I've received. There are probably other things, but they don't come to mind right now.
That's fair. Well, Dr. Brown, thank you so much for joining me today. It was good to have you on.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Chemistry conceptual developments. So today we're going to be introducing or talking about regiochemistry principles. So key things you want to keep in mind are, you want to understand the fundamentals of regiochemistry, understand Markovnikov's rule and the anti-Markovnikov's rule, and we want to try and understand Zaitsev's and Hoffman's rule. to regiochemistry principles and other ideas. Regiochemistry comes from the Latin word regionum, meaning direction. Regiochemistry describes the principles involved in the directionality or position and placement of reactants to form products. Regiochemistry is very important. We normally hear in advanced or high-level discussions of things being regioselective or regiodivergent, it's used a lot. So the reagent used can cause a specific regiochemical result or result in the opposite of what would normally occur. Markovnikov's rule. Markovnikov's rule, put simply, is he who has more gets more. Markovnikov's rule in the addition of a halide to an unsymmetrical alkene, the hydrogen goes to the carbon with the greatest number of hydrogens and the halide ion goes to the other carbon. In another way, this rule states that the halide adds so as to form the more stable carbocation intermediate. Anti-Markovnikov. Anti-Markovnikov is the reverse. He who has more gets less. In which the carbon with the greatest number of hydrogens does not receive the hydrogen, but the most electrophilic portion of the molecule. For example, in hydroboration oxidation in the presence of peroxides, the borohydrate adds to the less substituted carbon of the hydrogen, and the hydrogen adds to the more substituted carbon. In short, now mechanistically, it may occur slightly. It's a little bit more involved and more detailed, but in short, that's what we're going to say occurs. However, stability comes about because the electron density shifts from the electrophilic borohydride, resulting in it possessing a partially negative charge and the more substituted carbon possessing a partially positive charge. This is indeed stable due to the electron density donating capacity of the alkyl group, S character, and orbital overlap of the alkyl carbon. Alkyl group with alkyl or electron donating substituent provides stability. Zaitsev's rule. Zaitsev's rule is a directionality principle in which the more substituted alkene is favored through the use of a small base, such as ethoxide. Zaitsev's rule is very significant and aids in predicting products and elimination reactions. Hoffman's rule. Hoffman's rule is another directionality principle in which the less substituted alkene is favored through the use of a huge or large base, such as tert butoxide. Hoffman's rule is also very significant and aids in predicting elimination reactions. Hammond-Leffler postulate. The Hammond-Leffler postulate essentially states that the product resembles the molecular arrangement of the transition state. In simpler terms, the view on the potential energy hill continues in some ways as you follow through the potential energy journey. So progressing in that direction, we're going to talk about some new stuff today. Again, surveying the literature and looking at the work of Shantanu Roy, Stefan Gedecker, and Vladimir Hellman, we embark on the journey of the Bell-Evans-Polanyi principle. So typically, the Bell-Evans-Polanyi principle is valid for a chemical reaction that proceeds along the reaction coordinate over the transition state. And that concept is extended to molecular dynamics trajectories that in general do not cross the dividing surface between the initial and final local minima at the exact transition state. It's very important and it has a lot of implications. It's a conceptual tool in physical chemistry, and we have come to understand that this principle can be used to improve the efficiency of existing molecular dynamics based methods by tuning the energy of these molecular dynamic trajectories. Along with that, we'll be discussing the Dimroth principle or Dimroth rearrangements. These are frequently encountered in heteroamide chemistry and was first recognized in the triazole series. This term was coined in 1963 as a convenient way of referring to the isomerization proceeding by ring fission and subsequent recyclization, whereby a ring nitrogen and its attached substituent exchange place with an amino group in a position alpha to it. Moving right along, we discuss a mechanistic highlight. Today we'll be talking about the Suzuki cross-coupling reaction. The Suzuki cross-coupling, or the Suzuki Miura cross-coupling, is a type of palladium-catalyzed cross-coupling reaction. CC bond formation using aryl halides and organoboronic acids. It is one of the most important reactions in synthetic organic and medicinal chemistry. There are two suggested pathways. The oxo-palladium pathway is a preferred mechanism, as some may say, and the boronic pathway is another description of what occurs. Of course, these occur through catalytic cycles, and this reaction was likely first described around 1979. In 2010, Akira Suzuki, jointly with Richard F. Heck and Eiichi Nagishi, received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the development of palladium catalyzed cross-coupling reactions. Wrapping up the highlight section, we'll talk about Nobel highlights. So Zivant Arrhenius. Zivant Arrhenius was born on February 19, 1859, near Uppsala, Sweden. He received the Nobel Prize on December 10, 1903, in recognition of his theory of electrolytic dissociation. His father, Zivant Gustav Arrhenius, held a position at the University of Uppsala. His uncle, Johan Arrhenius, was a botanist, writer, and a longtime secretary of the Swedish Agricultural Academy in Stockholm. Zivant Arrhenius was an outstanding student in school. He learned reading and arithmetic at a very early age, and in his secondary school, excelled particularly in mathematics and physics. His physics teacher was M. Fladerus, author of the most popular contemporary Swedish secondary school physics textbook. His university degrees were all from the University of Uppsala. Definitely a chemist that worked hard. This ends the session of highlights for this podcast episode.
Thanks for listening. We're glad you were able to tune into this podcast. Once again, this is The New Chemist, where we discuss chemistry, which simply put is the science of change, as well as the other sciences, careers, community, research, and COVID-19. Thanks again for listening. Note, the views on this podcast represent those of my guests and I.
Purpose of these episodes not at all for advice or medical suggestions. These are aimed to provide support to peer pharmacists in training in educational and intellectually stimulating ways. Again, these are not at all for medical advice or medical suggestions. Please see your local board and state certified health professional. The views of this podcast represent those of my guests and I.
Okay, welcome to the New Student Pharmacist Podcast Experience. It's so good to have you listening in today. I guess today is Sebastian Kaff, Dr. Kaff. Wow. Last time I spoke with Sebastian, this was probably what, 2021? Was it 2021?
I've been
asking an interview. But I've known Sebastian since, give or take, 2016, 2015. That's about 9 years or so. 9 years, give or take. But yeah, man, Sebastian, how have you been? How have you been? How is Dr. Kaff? I just love the sound of it. I'm sure you do as well. How is Dr. Kaff today?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you so much. It's so great to be here. I remember talking to you last being on this podcast back in medical school. I was out in North Georgia mountains in a family medicine clinic where I was staying upstairs, and I was recording that from there, and we were discussing, and now here we are. It feels crazy that it's almost been a year since leaving medical school, or rather starting residency, and time flies so quickly. And I feel very grateful to be here in LA and be able to take advantage of some of the nature and everything so far, skiing and maybe a little bit of surfing here and there. It's been great.
Good. So just before we dive in, let me dive everyone here your biography. So Sebastian Kaff in the first year anesthesiology resident position at UCLA. Yeah, you heard me right, UCLA. That's where he went. So he went to Georgia Tech for undergrad, went to Medical College of Georgia for his doctorate in medicine. In medical school, he conducted research in anesthesiology and presented his research at several state and national conferences, as well as through publications and international reach journals. By the end of medical school, he was selected for induction into the Alpha Omega Alpha National Medical Honor Society. He's now completing his first year as a physician out in Los Angeles, California. In his free time, he is an avid runner, skier, DJ, we'll talk about that, and has started to get into surfing during the summer months. He hopes to pursue a career in academic anesthesiology and serve as faculty to teach future generations of medical students and residents. This is commendable. I get a thrill from seeing your success so far. So, could you share the enduring passions that led you to pursue a career in anesthesiology? Why anesthesia?
Yeah, of course. Of course, I'd love to talk about that. You know, I think many people enter medicine, with a desire to help others, and that can manifest in myriad ways, I think. Some people enjoy, long-term, patient relationships and being sort of the primary source of medical guidance for patients. And some people enjoy research and even affecting people at the population level, public health and academic research that advance the field of their choosing. And other people enjoy the acute setting of treatment or procedures to rapidly improve the health status of certain patients needing care. I ended up falling into the latter category and initially thought I was actually going to pursue a role in emergency medicine or even the trauma surgery space. But early on in medical school, I ended up shadowing an anesthesiologist, and immediately I felt the specialty really brought together my interest in both procedural care, that sort of rapid acting, solving a problem then and there, as well as pharmacology and physiology, which are lost in some other, I guess, procedural specialties. I really love that anesthesiology, we can assert a broad range of physiologic knowledge and procedural skills to help someone get through a very stressful, very taxing surgery or procedure with essentially little to no pain, which is a really cool and rewarding idea. There's certainly cons, in that if you do your job well, your patient doesn't even remember your name oftentimes, and you truly don't have those long-term relationships that you see in other specialties that see patients regularly or frequently throughout a treatment course. But everything in medicine, and of course any career, is really a set of pros and cons, and you choose what you think fits your personality and workflow the best, in the long term, envisioning how might I enjoy my job 5, 10, 30 years from now. And that's where I landed.
Okay, good. I'm glad you landed there. You're actually the second anesthesiologist I've had on this podcast. So this you the first one was Dr. Emery Brown from Harvard Medical School. Anesthesiologist statistician. So you're the second. Who knows, you may end up in the same space, hopefully. So in the demanding world of medicine, how do you ensure you maintain a holistic perspective on your career and life? How do you keep perspective, dude? I see you're doing a lot. It's good you have these hobbies outside of your work, but how do you keep a holistic perspective on your career and life?
Yeah, so I think, paradoxically in this career of helping other people, I think a holistic perspective of how we approach this career really starts with taking care of yourself first, when you're on an airplane, you're instructed to put on your own air mask in the case of an emergency before helping anyone else. And I think in medicine, we're called to do the same thing. Do your best to ensure your life and its foundation, whether it's health, fitness, relationships, hobbies, that they're at least in an operable and ideally a comfortable state, before you try to help someone else. And I think when you do that, you're going to be in good shape. When you do that, your perspective is going to be a little bit brighter, if not a lot brighter, on your daily life. I find that if you feel you're not taken care of, you start to develop resentment, towards a career that can take so much time and effort from you. And that resentment then leads into patient interactions and the sort of daily life work, which is, of course, a highly negative consequence that, none of us want for our patients or our colleagues in that sense. So in short, I think, the way I maintain perspective is I try to put on my own mask first and try to feel like I'm taken care of, and then everything else falls into place, I think, if your original intentions are positive and established.
Yeah, that's good. That's very good, actually. That's something to note. take care of yourself. So what innovative and adaptive approaches have you applied to excel in the field of anesthesiology? No longer in medical school, you're now in residency. So you're walking hallowed halls, if you will. So what innovative and adaptive approaches have you applied to excel? What are you doing now? Let me make this more practical. So what are you doing now that has changed from the last time you spoke? What has changed in terms of what you're doing for your preparation as you go to your job on a daily basis? So what has changed in your preparation? Is it more like more applied? Is it more case-centric? Is it more retrospective in terms of looking at what other people have done that has worked? What is Sebastian or Dr. Kaff? What is Dr. Kaff doing differently now?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think as we go along our path, we kind of have to shift, like you're saying, you know, your approach to every day. And I wish I had a novel approach to discuss, but so far I think I've, you know, tried and true method of diligent study and finding strong mentors that, you know, that you look up to as you go throughout your, at least my very brief career. But once you're beyond medical school, I've found that medicine is a surprisingly self-driven field. Sure, we have, you know, when you go through a residency program, you have procedural checklists, you know, you've done XYZ number of central lines, for example, and board exams that keep us generally up to speed in a standardized fashion, which of course everybody wants. But to a large extent, I think that the best residents and as a result, the best attendings, they're the ones who seek out work, who offer up their extra time, you know, to help with the procedure, and who especially look up, you know, recent literature or best practices to help them solve a problem with the patient. And I think those people are the ones that learn the most, at least from what I've seen, and are able to apply that knowledge in their day-to-day. You know, I'm certainly no, you know, gold standard benchmark to aspire to in that sense, but so I do try to understand the decisions I'm making, you know, when treating patients and learning from mistakes. And I think at the end of the day, you know, medical school is such a regimented, you know, do this, take an exam, do this, take an exam, try to impress people, be a good human, you know, apply for residency, all that stuff. But I think it's a lot more self-driven. You know, you're in this program and 4 years later, you're going to graduate most likely, statistically. But in that interim, you know, what opportunities do you seek out to improve yourself? I think that's what I've had to focus on a little bit more is staying that extra hour and doing that extra thing to gain that experience and understand things a little better.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can think of some of my I completely agree with you. Two ways, I would say. In terms of pharmacy school now at this time, all my professors said the exact same thing that you just said. Going for the extra work, you know, just a little bit extra, pushing a little bit more. I even think of some of my ongoing collaboration projects, you know, it's outside of my coursework. It's not really a grade. There's no grade associated with it, but it will benefit my career. And it's just an extra push that's required for the collaboration. So yeah, I agree with you completely. So how have you cultivated a sense of vision and fostered teamwork in your medical environment? It's no longer just you trying to make an A now, it's now you working with a team of medical professionals. I've heard lots of advice from different physicians or different people in healthcare. They say, make sure you befriend these particular groups of people in the hospital, like the nurses or the techs or the staff in the pharmacy. Sure. Make sure you befriend them, so especially when you're training, because they're very helpful. However, what do you do to cultivate a sense of vision and foster teamwork in your environment? I take it in some instances you are a leader in some of the spaces that you're in. So how are you fostering vision and fostering teamwork?
Definitely. You bring up a great point with being friends with the right staff members, which is everybody, you know. And I think, you know, I've had many night shifts where I have tried to go out of my way to talk to the nurses of the patients that I'm taking care of that night and sort of proactively address and say, hey, is there anything going on that's bothering you right now? Because, you know, at 2 or 3 a.m., that's a different question. And sometimes things go in a different direction. If we can go ahead and address it proactively, I'm here for you now. I will be then too. But what often happens is by offering up yourself a little bit extra in that way and trying to be friends with them and understand them and their names and why they're here and everything like that, they'll treat you even better and you know, take that extra step to help you, you know, make sure that patient is tucked away for the night before, you know, asking you a question at 3 a.m. that maybe is a little bit more of a stressful or harder question to answer at that time, or maybe things have changed or evolved in a bad way by then. So I think developing those relationships is really important professionally to sort of maintain our teamwork. And then I also really like the idea of fostering teamwork and helping to boost morale, you know, during the long days in the hospital. You know, where everybody's there because they envision we're able to heal and help someone, right? And we get bogged down by bureaucracy and paperwork and delays in care and not being able to go home. But I try to be a fairly positive person at work, you know, sharing snacks, throwing snacks at people, trying to inject some humor into the, you know, often absurd healthcare system. Mm-hmm. And just being a positive listener amongst colleagues, that those are some of the basic things I try to do. And I really appreciate when other people do the same thing, you know, and so I always hope that those small actions do the same for my colleagues. And, you know, everybody has good days and bad days and so on.
Oh, yeah.
So, but, overall, I think that all of it goes such a long way, because you realize in medicine, it's all such a team, you know. No one can both understand the disease and give the medication and take the patient down to the radiology and do the x-ray and read the x-ray. You know, it's so many people involved in all of that.
Yeah, it takes a team. Takes a team. You're very right. I really like what you said, you know, seeing people, like everyone, maybe befriending the right people, and that includes everyone. That's one thing that you said. And then the second thing that you said really stood out to me is, you know, seeing value in them to the point where you try to understand them in the role of the inn and also beyond the role of the inn. Like, why are they there? Why are they working with you? Yeah, that is very, very important. So how do you manage that, though? Because, you know, you can't go into people's life story when you're on, at least I don't think so, in practice, going into people's life story as you're working a shift or as you're reading a chart, sure, like their whole day. So how do you manage that? Is it just like key questions that you ask? Was it just like a moment by moment, free flowing, developing relationships with people?
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And it also extends to the patients, like you're saying, you know, understanding, you know, where they're going home to, or, you know, seeing a nurse's water bottle and seeing that there's a logo on it, you know, of a mountain, you know, asking about that. And I think we find those common bonds are so simple and so accessible. That it's so worth it to just try to not be a stranger, you know. I think that's such a positive part of it, and even the little things just matter so much. And those are some of the examples, I guess, you know, just asking patients about their hobbies and you know, asking the staff the same.
Okay, so what does Sebastian do to have fun? I see you DJ. What type of music are you DJing to? What's the Sebastian outside of the hospital? A fun going guy. What's Sebastian? Is it like loves to party? What's the Sebastian outside of the hospital? What funny story can you share with the audience, or what good story do you have within measure? You don't have to tell us your whole life story on the podcast. What funny story can you share with us, or some impactful story that you've had outside of the hospital that's really influenced your work in the hospital?
Cut
outside that's influencing what you do on the inside, giving you new perspective, or added some sense of like humor, or made you more self-aware. What could you say? What funny story could you share with us?
So this goes back to when I was in college. You know, the very first time I stepped foot in a club, I was 19 and I was the DJ.
Are you serious?
That was back in Atlanta, back when I was in college. And I think, you know, that those were some baby steps at the time, but I ended up kind of getting a little bit more into it and then out of it as I went in, you know, into medical school. And then I, you know, before going into medical school, I actually formed a techno duo with who's now my roommate, who moved out here with me to California. And we play various techno shows back in Atlanta and now also in Los Angeles. And it's a really fun time. And I think, you know, outside of one particular story, which there are many, many funny stories within all of that, I think the creative pursuit is so important to have when you're bogged down in a career like this one, you know, having some place to escape to where it may not feel productive in the true sense sometimes, especially when you're in school. You know, I could do this thing or I could study more for my test. You know, which one is more valuable to me in the long term? Often I think test is the red herring, and I think that you end up performing so much better when you've dedicated time outside of all of that to something that you care about, not just everybody else. And I think, you know, that's really led to an injection of fun into my life, and you know, playing a warehouse or a club or whatever it is, you know, and meeting people from different walks of life. And that's another huge thing, you know, in medicine, where everybody you talk to is the same. They're from the same places, went to the same schools, and are of the same education level. But not everybody is in the same path that you are, and it's so easy to forget that. And I think it just adds so much color to your life when you're a little bit outside of your daily life there.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. No, not everyone is in the same path or has the same passions or interests that you have. And we have to make space for that and to hear those people out. So what role has mentorship played in your career? Can you name some of your mentors? I know three off the top of my head. I could recite them if I get up in the middle of the night, and some of their work as well, and some of the things that they're currently doing. What about you? Who are some of your mentors?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, mentors have had a deep impact on my growth, especially I think on an interpersonal level and how to live your life as a physician and making it meaningful, you know, just kind of like we talked about, both at work and outside of work. You know, for example, I worked with a family medicine practitioner back in medical school. It was actually the same physician I was working with when I talked to you last time. His name's Dr. Samuel Church. And he essentially runs his own clinic up in North Georgia with, you know, essentially is a, in his own way, is a sort of catchment center for a whole giant area of people in North Georgia and even up into North Carolina that come and see him, because there's just not that many clinics out there. And he showed me not only how to approach, you know, broad primary care medicine from an evidence-based perspective, but he also showed me how he, you know, runs the financial aspects of his practice and how he tends to his family and makes them a priority even throughout these crazy days and going between cities. How he impacts his community through advocacy and charity and just good connections and helping other families, you know, sons and daughters through various difficult times in their lives, because he's involved in their lives to that extent. Those are the things that really stuck with me, you know. And you know, another physician I worked with, a plastic surgeon back in medical school, who he had a very high standard of his students. And initially, you know, he was one of the people that, you know, I asked him for feedback after 1 week, and he said, "Sebastian, I'm disappointed in you." And he told me straight up that, you know, I had already done general surgery, I should know X, Y, and Z in the operating room. And I really appreciated that he gave me that feedback, because at the end of those 3 or 4 weeks, you know, I learned his dance and I learned what he expected. And he was one of the people that ended up writing me a letter of recommendation for residency, because I think he was someone that was so involved and so critical to my growth professionally.
Yes.
And those are some of the people. And even he taught me a lot about, you know, how to navigate the business of medicine and how to navigate, you know, your own well-being within all of that.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else before I go into my take on that? Anyone else to mind?
Those are that come to mind.
Okay, good. Yeah, dude. Same thing with me. For me, it's been my dad. My dad's a physician. Even though I'm not taking the path of going into medicine, I'm going into pharmacy. My dad has been like a very big role model for me, a very big mentor, as well as one of my academic professors. My thesis for grad school, the person who was the chair of my thesis committee, Dr. Wadlansky. You know, he was very, very, had very, very high standards, dude. Like, when I worked on my thesis, he would tell me straight up, "David, what you wrote does not make sense, or what you wrote needs to change, or what you wrote." Like, he was very particular, even down to the spaces between the charges, the spaces between the commas, beyond just the content. Of course, the content had to be accurate, but how the content was presented. Because I grew to understand that not only reflected me, it also affected him. And of course, he supported my thesis to the point where it was published by the university. You know, so it's definitely, I completely agree with you. You know, those people who hold you to a high standard, sometimes it's not comfortable. In all honesty, it's not comfortable, but it allows you to grow, because sometimes growth and comfort are not always linked. Yeah, within the healthy context, within the healthy context. So yeah, man, Sebastian, what advice does Dr. Calf have for people who are in medical school, who are entering residency, who are trying to match? What advice does Dr. Calf have? What nuggets can you share with the audience as we wrap up?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, of course, beyond the you know, do as well as you can in school and all of that good stuff, which is actually very important. I think the biggest thing is getting a lot of exposure, you know, getting as much exposure as possible. Be interested, make yourself available to anesthesiologists, identify ones that you might be able to learn from or make a mentor for you. And I think after that, the specialty will you know, welcome you with open arms. I think that thinking about the longer term aspects of medicine, such as how you might deal with, you know, certain patient loads or certain ways of serving patients. Again, what we talked about at the beginning, long-term, short-term surgical versus medical approaches should be at the core of your specialty decision. And then how you approach applying into that specialty. You know, if I'm going into a surgical subspecialty, you know, not anesthesiology, but, you know, any, you know, cardiothoracic surgery or orthopedic surgery, you know, how much room is there to go into academics versus private practice? What kind of city can I live in? How tied am I to one specific practice? You know, do I need to be business minded or am I okay being an employee somewhere? You know, these are things that are intimately tied to the specialty in which you practice and shouldn't be ignored. So in that sense, get exposure, identify then if it's the right field for you now that you've seen what it's like to do what the actual day-to-day work is like, you know, being in an OR almost 100% of the time that you're at work, you know, how does that feel for you? And then honestly, it even in medicine, it does come to connections. You know, if you want to match in a certain location or a certain place, how can you get in front of the people that you are interested in communicating with to arrive at that goal? And, you know, is it a conference or is it a regional conference near that institution where faculty and staff may be approachable? And you can talk to them and ask if you can, you might be able to have a chat with them about their program and what they feel is a good part or a bad part about their program. And of course, you're at the mercy of the match system. And a lot of that comes down to, you know, numbers and exposure. But I think that in some ways, it is a very modifiable and very malleable process in the sense that at the end of the day, it's not a black box. You know, it's not, there's people on the other end that are making those decisions, and people are the things that make up institutions. It's not just Harvard. It's not just UCLA. It's not just, you know, UGA. It's people that are sitting there making those decisions. And at the end of the day, if you know, you manage to have a conversation with someone that's positive, that's likely going to go a long way in a world where it's just numbers and stats, you know?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, man. So Sebastian, it was so good to have you on the podcast today. You know, from Dr. Brown to Dr. Calf, we have hosted the brightest and the best and the future. yes, man. This is good, man. Thanks, Sebastian, for joining me. I'm so glad to have you on today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Purpose of these episodes not at all for advice or medical suggestions. These are aimed to provide support to peer pharmacists in training in educational and intellectually stimulating ways. Again, these are not at all for medical advice or medical suggestions. Please see your local board and state certified health professional. The views of this podcast represent those of my guests and I.
Thanks for listening to the podcast series, The New Student Pharmacist, where we discuss chemistry and pharmacy, as well as leaders in pharmacy careers, community, and chemistry and pharmacy research. We encourage you to support the work we are doing and follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by subscribing for free. We are so glad that you were able to tune in today. Note, the views on the podcast represent those of my guest, and I take care and all the best.